I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, the question is, what should the press do about Donald Trump? You don't need to be reminded, but I'll remind you anyhow. He has said some pretty racist comments during the course of this campaign. He has called Mexican roots rapists and drug mules, and I assume some are good people, he said. He's called for a ban on all Muslims from entering the country, didn't immediately repudiate David Duke and the KKK. On John McCain, he said, I like people who weren't captured. He has disparaged women, most famously calling Carly Fiorina ugly and questioning Megyn Kelly's competence, referencing the fact that she menstruated. He has turned debate and victory speeches into spectacles. Last night's was unbelievable. It went on for, I was trying to keep track of it, 35 minutes, I think, and all three of the cable networks were covering every moment of it, even though there were other things happening in the race that were interesting. We heard him talking about his golf clubs and his water and his Trump University and stakes, and it was, I don't think I've ever seen anything like it before. He's created a confrontational atmosphere at his events, made fun of a reporter with a disability, encouraged his supporters to punch protesters in the nose, saying that he would cover the court costs, bragged that he could shoot someone in the middle of Times Square, and kicked out Jorge Ramos of a press conference. Jorge Ramos was on Morning Edition this morning, and I thought that what he said was a good way to frame what we're going to be talking about this hour. We'll have three guests with us. Brooke Gladstone, co-host of On the Media, later Jay Rosen, journalism professor at New York University, and Michael Wagner, professor of journalism and mass comm at UW-Madison. But I think that this is the question that I want us all to address here this hour. Jorge Ramos, who is anchor of the evening news on Telemundo, was on Morning Edition this morning and talked about Donald Trump. And here is what he said.
Support for W.
Do you think of yourself as an advocacy journalist? Is that the right phrase for what you do?
I've been asked if I'm an activist or a journalist. And my answer is very simple. I'm just a journalist who asks questions. The difference is that I'm completely convinced that there are a few moments, important moments, in which you have to take a stand as a journalist. When it comes to racism, discrimination, corruption, public lies, dictatorships, and human rights, you have to take a stand as a reporter. Because I think our responsibility as journalists is to confront those who are abusing power.
Do you have to take a stand? How does the press deal with all that's been said? That's a question of the hour. I happen to agree with what Jorge had to say, but I'm sure listeners have different opinions, and some of our guests may as well. Brooke Gladstone is our first guest, a voice that you will instantly recognize. She's co-host of On the Media. You hear it on Wisconsin Public Radio every Friday at 6. She was an NPR Moscow-based reporter, and she has been senior editor of NPR's All Things Considered. She's won many very prestigious awards, the recipient of two Peabody Awards, a National Press Award, Overseas Press Award, author of The Influencing Machine, and later we'll speak with other guests about this issue. Brooke Gladstone, thank you ever so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I have never seen a candidate. I'm not a young person anymore. I've never seen anything like this in my whole life, Brooke. Have you?
Well, it may be that this isn't something that's happened in the last half century or so. I'm not going to estimate your age, but I will reveal mine. I mean, this may not be something that's happened for 70 or 80 years. This could be a political realignment, which is probably why so many of the pollsters got Trump wrong.
Mm. What do you think of what Jorge had to say? I think of all of us as people who have to cover this guy, in some instances you'd prefer not to, but he's such a force. Are there things that need to be called out? Is there a way to be balanced with the coverage of a candidate like Trump?
Of course there is, and that is to engage him on the issues, on the grounds of what he says. I think that part of the problem with the press, which tend as a group to be rather isolated and clustered on the coasts, is that they don't understand that what Donald Trump says doesn't matter terribly much. He represents a kind of emotional orientation and whether or not somebody thinks that it's okay to kill the family of a terrorist, he doesn't really mind that much, or she doesn't mind that much, because what this is about is a group of voters who are so tired of the way both parties have not served them that they basically want someone to come in who has no limits to take it down.
Mm. But when he says some of the things that he has said, Brooke, is it the responsibility? I know even NBC has brought in Tom Brokaw to say some things, putting this in a historical context. Jorge has been kicked out of one of his press conferences and said something about what he's saying. Is it a responsibility? Is it an Edward R. Murrow kind of tradition to say, wait a second, you just need to be called out on some of what you're saying?
It's a fascinating question, because after a mid-century of a kind of pose of objectivity and a sense that you were going to stay safely uninflected in the middle, so that it happened basically with the birth of television. They needed super huge audiences. An incredibly opinionated press became one that was characterized by a kind of priestly objectivity that could never really exist, but gave everybody cover and didn't piss anybody off, if you'll pardon the expression. So what we have is a situation here where the media are changing, and maybe a lot of us in it are moving back to a period where expressing your values was okay. Mm. In fact, that was a kind of sunlight. Here's where I'm coming from, news consumers. So take what I say in that context. Also, our values, our shared values of a nation, change over time. I mean, everybody points to a growing acceptance of, you know, gay marriage. But if you go back 100 X number of years, there was a legitimate debate in the press going on about racism. They voted down lynching laws in the
right.
Congress.
Yeah.
These things were not obvious to a people, that sense of right and wrong. And so now reporters have to say, am I going to say this is wrong? Am I going to stand up mm-hmm. for what I believe, or am I not? You have to be careful when you do that, that you stick to the facts and you don't attack Trump's voters, because we don't really, unless we are one, we won't really understand Trump voters.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit, Brooke, about the way the press has covered him. I do think that they thought, this guy isn't going anywhere. I don't think too many people thought that he'd be where he is right now. He has been given an incredible amount of particularly television coverage. I'm just astounded. I'm a little bit of a political junkie here, so I've watched, you know, every single debate. I watch the cable shows to get analysis. I'm just deeply immersed, probably too deeply immersed in all of it. And I was watching last night. I couldn't believe this was a particularly rambling kind of, it wasn't even a political talk that he was giving in Miami. He was talking about his steaks and the water and his Palm Beach this and that and his clubs and how successful he is. And all the major networks, when it was a big primary night, when there were some interesting things happening in Michigan, you couldn't even figure out what was happening there, because all of the cable networks, CNN and Fox and MSNBC, covered that speech for, it must have been 35 minutes. I couldn't believe
right.
it. What was
they
going-
didn't have Hillary on or
no.
anybody else until much later. And am I right in thinking that he distributed some of his Trump steaks
yes,
to the crowd?
Yes, I believe he did, yes.
Which shows that he has no fear of metaphor, because he was
exactly
you know, literally throwing
red meat. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, right. Everybody loves a good show. Dean Baquet at the New York Times sat in on that famous off-the-record session that Trump had with editors there. And he said he did it because he wanted to watch the show. That is a problem. That is baked into the media business. You provide what sells, and Trump sells. But can I just say one thing about the incredible, what appears to be huge over-coverage of Trump.
Yes.
And last night's a perfect example. And that is, we've been trying to examine this question on our show. We've been partnering with Nate Silver and 538.com. And they've been using Google searches to try and determine whether the media have been leading the public, trailing it, or staying apace with the public's interest. And if you go by Google searches, which represents a genuine curiosity, there were times when even when the media were given, or the television media was giving, 45% or more, 60% of the coverage to Trump, that the Google searches were even higher. So the fact is that he isn't purely a news media phenomenon. He may be a media phenomenon because he was so familiar through his reality TV show, but he isn't the creation of the political press, although they certainly haven't stood in his way.
Yeah, I would love to see what was happening with with last night, though, because it was just so rambling. I'm wondering if...
Things have gone past that now. I was talking about the creation.
I see.
What's gone on now? You know how it is with the political press. They get into grooves.
Right.
There is a habit that takes place cycle after cycle. Once it's in it, it doesn't get out.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you look at it, and I know you're in public media and so am I, but you know something because of the show you do. When you look at decisions that are made by network heads as to what you're going to do when you do your political coverage, because it's their mainstay, they're getting a lot of response here, maybe partially because of Donald Trump. But are you thinking of service to the public, or are you thinking of how much money you can make for a network? And he's big money. People watch him. And so that's why they spend so much time on him. Is that true?
I think that there is an element of that. Of course, the debate that he sat out did almost as well. So
did it really?
In fact, it was something like the second biggest thing that Fox had ever done, or it was Fox he sat out on. So, or was it CNN? Whatever it was, I think it was Fox. It was the second biggest that they'd ever had in ratings. So, he's created a great media environment. The editors or the producers or whoever makes the decisions, the gatekeepers, think it's what the public wants. To a great degree, that's true. When you talk about public service, yeah, then we have a problem. But don't we have a problem during every election season? I mean, the talk of the horse race rather than the issues.
Yes.
That happens time and time again. I mean, I've covered so many campaigns. I've never heard when that hasn't been the biggest criticism of the media. And who talks about the horse race more than anybody else? Who is more up on the polls than anybody else? That would be Donald Trump.
Yeah. Well, skip the polls now. I couldn't believe the polls yesterday. What the heck happened there? It was just incredible. So, yeah. All right, let's go.
Well, the thing is that you have to, I think the most important thing that we as the media class could do is to address him on the issues. Can you build a wall? How do you build a wall? How much does that cost? What would be the political fallout? What would be the benefit? Why bother with a wall when there's a much larger group of Mexicans, say, leaving the country right now than are actually arriving? It's not a problem. It is now in the negatives. So there's that. So you could address on the issues. And we were told very early on when we did a piece about demagogues that history shows us that laughing off a demagogue does not work. It does not work because you're not just dissing the guy. You're dissing the people who support him. You need to address him on the issues. In fact, you need to take him seriously on the issues. And that is something that the political press and the pundits did not do and did not do and did not do all the way mm-hmm. through this campaign. They just sort of closed their eyes, put their fingers in their ears, went na 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 na, and hoped that he would go away. So that was just a terrible strategy right there. But I think that if you feel that the things that he is saying are profoundly antithetical to the values we all share, and I know what you're coming from, mm-hmm. you can address those absolutely directly. Now, you mentioned Murrow. McCarthy was sending people to jail. People were killing themselves. People had lost their careers. He was having an active impact everywhere he went, and he had engaged a large part of the Congress in this enterprise for far too long. Trump, so far, there's not been a single vote cast in the presidential election. He is an expression of something, a kind of primal scream. His margins are the greatest in the parts of the country where we read recently about that study of middle-aged white men and women who are dying in extraordinary numbers from suicide and drug abuse and alcoholism, a sense of misery, a sense of incipient fear, a sense of threat that, as we hear over and over again, their country is going away. Well, you know, their country may be going away. And this is that horrible sense of loss and worthlessness being given expression, perhaps. It's something to consider. Mm-hmm. If you talk to, if you hear, as we both have, a lot of Trump supporters talking about Trump, what do they say? He's strong.
Right,
you know?
Absolutely.
And, you know, if you say, and he's a good deal maker, if you say, well, actually, he hasn't made very good deals, he hasn't been such a great businessman, and I can offer you, you know, this evidence and this evidence. Ultimately, it isn't about that. It's that Trump is willing to just speak without limits and take it down.
Yeah, he sure is. Brooke Gladstone is with us. She is co-host of On the Media. We're talking about Donald Trump and how the press should handle him this hour of the program. And welcome to your phone calls. What do you think? Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We're on Facebook, where we'd also love to read your comments, please. The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at K Dunn Show. Let's go to Pat in Milwaukee first. Hi, Pat.
Hey, guys. And I mean, I don't exactly remember the Walter Cronkite days. I wasn't quite alive then. But I just feel it gets to the question that in the past 20 to 30 years, it feels like journalism and journalists and reporting, they've gone from reporting the news to making the news to the point now where it seems like a lot of them think of themselves as D-level, highly paid celebrities. And, you know, just for example, I've been watching a lot of CNN, not because I particularly think it's that great of a network, but I've heard they've put a ton of money into their political coverage, and they've made it a great investment, and the ratings have been up. And what it is it's eight people sitting around two different tables out on the East Coast looking at each other and longingly gazing at the person who just made a comment, thinking it's the most brilliant thing in the world, and then the next one makes another comment that's more brilliant than the last one. And it's just, I think the rest of us out in, let's call it middle America, our lives are so different from all of those people.
All right, let's get Brooke's response. Brooke.
Right. I mean, I couldn't agree more with everything that you just said. There's nothing that seems more out of touch than those people whose brilliant comments are generally limited to political strategy, not about anything relevant to people's lives. And they are highly paid, maybe not quite as much as they were a few years ago, but they're still really highly paid. And why anybody watches them, why you watch them, my friend, is a question that I would like to know, because you know, it drives me kind of crazy that even though the viewers of cable news are far, far smaller than you would give them credit for, because they have an inordinate influencing power, particularly Fox, nevertheless, people still tune in. Why do they watch that stuff? I never watch that unless I am absolutely compelled to because of my job, and I've helped engineer the job so that I'm hardly ever compelled to. So why? Can I ask your listener, why? Why?
Yeah, well, I watch it too, so you can ask me why. And I, except that last night I thought to myself, why am I doing this? I should be doing something else. I think it's just sort of being in the experience for me. I don't think anybody says anything profound. Every now and then somebody, some panelist will say something interesting, certainly. Yeah, maybe it's the same reason I watch the news every night. I want television news. I do. I watch it. I've been watching it every day of my life since I was a kid. And so I keep doing that. Sometimes you get some new information, but increasingly, you're right. There is very little to be gleaned from any of these programs. And I guess it's a feeling of, you know, kind of wanting to be in the know, wanting to feel like I'm where the election is taking place now, to be a part of the political process. It isn't much of an answer.
Yeah, that's true. I just want to say something about Walter Cronkite.
Okay.
He was a great newsman. You know, there was one vote in the 70s that called him, dubbed him the most trusted man in America. And then later, many years later in the internet age, they did a similar poll for people 18 to 35. And the most trusted man in America in news was Jon Stewart. And they weren't kidding.
Right.
And
I
think that it tells you something about the culture.
Mm-hmm.
Jon Stewart discloses with big mugging faces sometimes what he believes and how he feels. He doesn't pretend to be some disconnected ghostly voice from on high telling us what we want to know. Our uncle, like Uncle Walter was mm-hmm. called back in the day. And the thing is that Walter Cronkite, during the coverage of early civil rights, was one among many newsmen who initially disparaged the marchers for being, you know, essentially, he didn't use the phrase troublemakers, but, you know, publicity seekers and, you know, anti-war. You know, it took a long time for Walter Cronkite to really be reflecting the public when he said that the Vietnam War wasn't winnable. A lot of people in the military still believe the media created the resistance to the war, but actually, the media was very, very late to that party, and that includes Cronkite.
And Walter Cronkite, though, could have been, it's been written, responsible in some measure for Lyndon Johnson saying, well, if I've lost Walter, I've lost the country. Goodbye.
That might be apocryphal. That could have happened. I think that is attributed to Bill Moyers, but he's a little fuzzy on that now. But the thing is that even though Johnson may have said it, he'd already lost Middle America when the casualties hit about 20,000 Americans.
Yeah. We'll take more phone calls for Brooke in a moment. We're talking about how the press should be handling Donald Trump. And Brooke Gladstone is our guest for the first part of the show. She is co-host of On the Media. More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we'll take a couple more phone calls for Brooke and then just change guests. Same topic. Sheree in Waupun is next. Hi, Sheree.
Hi. Thank you so much for the show.
Sure.
I wanted to make a point because I do watch a lot of the coverage that goes on. And I have to say that I respectfully disagree with Ms. Gladstone in the sense that I've seen journalists ask Donald Trump questions over and over, George Stephanopoulos, Chuck Todd, just try to dig in and try to get a solid answer. You know, when you ask him about defense, oh, it's just going to be huge. Okay, but how? It seems like a simple question, and he produces a word salad of literally nothingness. And then when you ask him several times, it gets to the point where it's just uncomfortable. And then they move on because it's obvious he's not going to answer the question. And it's obvious to me that his promoters really don't care about the answers. I think he's tapped into an anger. I think they feel powerful when they're with him because I think there's a camaraderie that he brings. I'm ashamed of the brass and the attitude. It's almost scary to a certain degree, but it's a show, and I think he's mastered the show. So I have to say, as much as I would not like to be, I am worried that he's going to become president because it seems like such a distraction. It's like looking at the silvery, jingly thing on the corner while he's doing something else. It's a sad state of politics.
Thanks, Sheree, for the call, Brooke.
Sherry, I just want to say that I agree with you. There have been efforts to ask hard questions, and he deflects them effortlessly, and it doesn't seem to matter all that much. I think that there could be and should be more questions asked, even when he isn't on the program, and more facts given. But yes, I certainly take your point. Kathleen, can I ask you a question?
Of course.
Are you yourself struggling with this?
Oh, yes.
Because of, and is it because you feel that there's something that needs to be said and you're constrained in your role as the host of this program to actually say it?
No, I've said it.
And so where's the struggle?
The struggle is that I have not done that before, I don't think, and I've been in broadcasting for a long, long time, but I've said it, and I do think that there's something dangerous about him. And I've always felt that it was important, just ethically, to call out racism, to call out, you know, a religious kind of bigotry. I've always thought that, you know, that's kind of an important thing, and it doesn't happen all that often. Gay marriage issues, I've been doing this for a long, long time, and I'm fair-minded to everybody, and we have people of very many different political persuasions. But when I called out Trump on issues of race, on the David Duke thing, I did get response from the audience saying that, you know, I was biased here. And I guess on this particular issue, I don't know how to be fair to him, because I don't think he's fair to anybody, and it's pretty alarming to me. I really am afraid of this candidacy. I haven't seen it before, and I'm afraid of it. So, you know, I'm a human. I do a talk show, and I think it's okay to express that every now and then. And then I thought, well, what the heck? Let's do a show on this, because that's why we're doing this with you and other people. I thought mm-hmm. it would be a good thing to talk about.
You know, there's a circle of Dante's hell for people who make what was called the Great Refusal. It had to do with whether or not cardinals would either stand with a pope or not. But those who refused to take a position were relegated to this part of Dante's hell. And later on, JFK said that the hottest places are reserved for those who, in time of moral crisis, preserve their neutrality. Mm-hmm. It is a difficult position when you have a microphone.
Yes, it is.
How do you inform mm-hmm. and not needlessly alarm, but, you know, if you see an impending threat, can you say it? Can you, or must you pretend it doesn't exist? You know, there's something that you mentioned the book that I wrote. I have a bunch of biases that are baked into the business there, and one of them is called Fairness Bias, a kind of false balance that took place over many, many years
yes.
of the coverage of global warming. And I'm just saying that we may be in one of those moments as well. When do you pull the lever to say what must be true, even though to others it may not seem true, and they are just as convinced as you are that it's not true?
Absolutely. Excellent point. One more call for you, and it's Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, hi. First of all, I love both your radio shows. You both provide an incredible service to everyone, so much appreciated to both of you. I just want to say, unfortunately, there are many, as you said, in the media class and others who continue to portray his rambling as entertainment, but his blathering about migrants may be having real effects on real people. BBC just reported yesterday the Prime Minister of Slovakia announced his government, quote, will no longer accept any Muslims, end quote, when it takes in Syrian refugees under an EU relocation scheme. So this announcement completely reversed Slovakia's position on refugee conventions and Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Slovakia had signed both of them, as have we, and now they've decided to chuck those responsibilities down the toilet. So is this Trump's fault? No, not directly, but when the leading Republican candidate for president says he will bar entry to Muslims, it's a lot easier for a small country like Slovakia to do so, and now they have. And I'm just wondering, are we next? This is not entertainment. These are real effects on real people. Anyway, that's just my comment.
Thanks, Jeff. Thank you, Brooke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know what the impact of his rhetoric is in the rest of the world. Certainly, there has been that movement in Europe for since the migration crisis began, and there have been great barriers to entry that go beyond the conventions that most of the globe has signed. So I don't know if I can lay that at Trump's door, and I know that the caller wasn't either. Does the rhetoric help? Maybe it does. It probably would have happened anyway because the migration has continued unabated. So it's hard to prove. I mean, having that kind of stuff out there is very discomforting. But mm-hmm. a lot of people will say, you know, many in his party have suggested things in the form of a dog whistle that is recognizable to those who want to hear that and not to those who don't want to hear it. And some suggest that maybe he's just dispensed with the whistle and is speaking in plain language. And to many, that's just a relief.
Mm. Brooke, thank you so much for being with us and starting this conversation. And thanks for your show. I really like it very, very much. Thanks.
Thank you.
Brooke Gladstone, she is the co-host of WNYC's On the Media, and you hear the program here on Wisconsin Public Radio every Friday at 6 o'clock. We're continuing the conversation, how the press should be dealing with the candidacy of Donald Trump and all that it brings forward in terms of money and press coverage for him, in terms of what he's saying, in terms of the dangerousness of some of what he has said, and whether or not he needs to be called out. Is there a responsible way to cover this candidacy? Is there a fair way, a balanced way? We have two more guests with us now. Jay Rosen is a journalism professor at the New York University. He has served as chair of the department and is author of Press Think, a web blog about journalism. He has been published in The Nation, Chronicle of Higher Education, New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Newsday, and many other publications. And Jay, we thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And also Michael Wagner is joining us, professor in the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. And he recently authored a piece, The Deal, on the Art of Covering Donald Trump, 10 Strategies for Journalists. And Michael, thank you very much for being with us as well. Hi. We can hear him, but he can't hear me. So let's get this figured out. And we will start with Jay Rosen. Oh, Jay, there's so much Donald Trump, and I just want to be doing something else. What is the best way to deal with this, man? And if you would, please just start with a response. If you were watching, maybe you weren't, cable news last night. The fact that this speech went on and on and on and on and on for 35 minutes, and everybody's covering that and not the other things. On a night we wanted the horse race, we were getting Donald Trump talking about, you know, the water and the Palm Beach and this and that, and it was just way out there. How should we cover this guy? And are you worried about how we are covering him?
Well, the first thing I would say about last night is it's helpful to think of Trump in this election as akin to an independent producer in Hollywood who makes shows that are popular, more popular than the shows the network's own people make.
Mm-hmm.
And because he is the producer and star of a very popular show, namely Trump or Trump as candidate,
mm-hmm.
he almost has leverage over the journalists who are supposed to be deciding what's important. And I think you saw that leverage in that extraordinary display of just letting the cameras roll simply because they're addicted to this show. So it's really important to see that he has a kind of power over journalists who are used to being able to make decisions about what's newsworthy themselves. As to the larger question of how to cover Trump, I don't think there is one good answer to that. But I certainly believe that one thing that's hurt the political press is that political coverage is mostly uniform in the U.S. When you look at the approach that the news media takes across, let's say, the television networks, NPR, major newspapers, Time magazine, almost everybody does it exactly the same way with the same set of premises. And I think that's hurt the press a lot. It hurt the press, for example, in their inability to predict that any of this would happen, and the way, as Brooke said, that they all, you know, dismiss these possibilities over the summer quite immediately. So I don't think there's a right way to do it, and what I would like to see is more pluralism. Some people could be calling out Trump. Some people could be doing it the way the Huffington Post is doing it, of literally putting at the bottom of every article, this guy's a racist.
Right, right.
Which I think is an interesting approach, right? There's certainly room for people who simply show what Trump is saying and let people draw their own conclusions. That's okay, but there should be room for doing like what you did. This guy has crossed a line. Calling him out, I think Trump has violated so many conventions of running for president, and he's such an anomaly and a kind of an explosion that there isn't a good simple answer to how to cover him, and we need lots of different approaches.
Yeah, we have a ton of people who want to join this conversation. Pat writes an interesting comment. I'd like your response on Facebook. I've seen a disclaimer on one print media site that I think is good, which expresses their negative view of Trump, maybe what you were just referencing. The press needs to take responsibility for their part in the circus and then have strategies to limit exposure. Mm-hmm. He doesn't really answer questions. He just boasts. Will media own up to their role? If someone is physically injured, which they were, a Time correspondent was chokeholded to the ground, for heaven's sake, or killed. I worry about that, too, that somebody's going to get seriously hurt at one of these events, not to mention emotional and psychological damage done already to many attendees and reporters.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I agree with that. I agree that one has the sense that some violence is going to erupt at a Trump rally eventually, and that's a very disturbing thing to know and not be able to stop it. But I think the problem with controlling coverage of Trump is that most political journalists don't actually have a good metric for knowing when coverage is useful or not, because their purpose in doing it is kind of circular to begin with. They cover the campaign to figure out who's going to win the campaign.
Right.
And because there's sort of a lack of any sense of what we're trying to accomplish here, it's very hard to say that this deserves more coverage and this deserves less. And so what you end up with is either the metric is who's ahead, who's winning, which means more Trump,
mm-hmm.
or commercial considerations, like what helps the ratings, which means more Trump.
Right.
So it's the absence of a larger goal. Now, what do I mean by a larger goal? Well, if Wisconsin Public Radio started its coverage by determining early in the campaign cycle, these are the most important issues that people in Wisconsin want the candidates to be discussing, and determine through a lot of effort and through a lot of reporting what those most important issues to the people in Wisconsin were, then they could begin to evaluate how valuable Trump's 35-minute infomercial was last night by whether it shed any additional light on the things that matter to people in Wisconsin.
Yes,
that kind of approach, which I call the citizen's agenda approach to coverage and
mm-hmm.
in politics, has been around since the 1990s. I've written about it. I've pushed for it. If journalists wanted to do something like that, they would have done it a long time ago. The truth is they like the insider game. They like the horse race. They like being part of, like, the business of elections. They like being inside that machinery. And so they were vulnerable to somebody like Trump.
Yeah. Let's. Michael is joining us now, I think. Are you there now, Michael?
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay, I'm sorry we had a little problem there. Michael Wagner, professor in the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. I don't know if you had it. You're probably figuring out the mics and everything going on here, but Jay made an interesting point. I'd like to start with what he said. How should networks, how should journalists determine what is most useful in covering the Trump campaign? Can we do that, or is it just so out there that it's really hard to even determine what's useful?
I think they should let, or they should stop letting Trump drive the agenda of what gets covered, and instead focus more on comparing the policy proposals that he makes, which admittedly are very few,
right,
the proposals that his opponents make, and looking at what do experts say about the likelihood of these things actually happening? What do lawmakers say about the likelihood of these proposals actually happening? And compare them side by side, rather than let Trump's latest insults or latest claims that stretch the definition of truth pretty far or just outright cross into outright lying drive the conversation, which has happened, I think, too much on the national stage.
Mm-hmm. Can either of you remember, give us a historical reference, and maybe there is something out of the 19th century when none of us happened to be alive to follow, but I mean, there have been some pretty outlandish campaigns, but I can't remember anything quite like this in terms of a presidential run as long as I've been around. Can you give us a historical reference?
Well, I would say, you
know, I don't know of anything like this since the television age began and
yeah,
the 1960 election with Kennedy and Nixon. I've been following politics very closely as a professional observer since 88, which is seven elections, and there's certainly nothing even close to this.
Right. You, Michael?
I think that's right in the television era. I think, you know, in, as far as American presidential campaigns, you know, the Adams-Jefferson one was very ugly in the things that these former friends said about each other. Even some of the storied Lincoln-Douglas debates had lots of personal insults attached to them. And so, you know, that's not new, but having it be in this news cycle with this many, this high number of sources, this fragmented media environment, this is new, I think, and it's been hard for everyone to handle, the news media and Donald Trump's opponents on the Republican side.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to add, Kathleen, that periods of high participation in politics and elections go hand in hand with spectacle, entertainment, and a kind of circus atmosphere in politics. And so we shouldn't be surprised that the outrageousness of Trump has also, for all its downsides, had the upside of increasing engagement and interest in politics, and that is a good thing.
Yeah, I understand that. There is something, though, about, and maybe this is why all of us are in universities and we work for public radio and we read books and have presidential people like Abraham Lincoln is mine, who I can read about endlessly, that there's some substance there. There's something about, and I will freely admit that I haven't watched reality television programs, and so maybe I don't fully understand the Trump phenomena, but there's something about spending so much time on things that, forgive me, I got an opinion here and I'll say it, seem so worthless to me. There's so many issues that are so crucially important, and to be distracted by things that are taking up gobs and gobs of time that just don't elevate our minds in any way. Are either of you bothered by that? It just drives me crazy sometimes.
Well, I don't think this has been a substance-free campaign. And when you look at Trump, he is discussing issues. He's just not putting any details at all in his discussion. He's talking about immigration. He's talking about the refugee crisis. He's talking about the
yes,
economy. But he has absolutely no detail for what
right,
you do. He'll say, I'm going to build a wall and make Mexico pay for it.
Right.
And the only person who's really pushed him on that was Stephen Colbert, and on a national stage where he pretended to be the president of Mexico and said, no, I won't do that. Now what are you going to do?
Right.
Change the subject.
Right. What do you say to that? Jay, you're covering, you've been covering politics since 88. How do you deal with the lack of substance? Not entirely, but certainly from him. There's just a lack of depth.
Well, I don't think it's possible simply by pressing Trump to get the kind of detailed answers that journalists are looking for, because he actually doesn't know anything. I mean, he doesn't really have the details. And I think it's important also to recognize that presidential campaigns are not just about issues and policy stands. They're also expressive activities. They're rituals, if you will. And for me, the longer this particular campaign has gone on, the more I think that it comes down to a group of voters, about 35 to 40% of the Republican electorate, who are saying in one way or another, this is how much we hate you. That's how I understand
it. Yeah, that's right, right.
This is how much we hate you, political class, but also journalists, media class, the people who run campaigns, the people who run elections. This, we hate you and what you've done this much.
Yes, I know.
So
it's very sad.
Put it in your face.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think that's right. A new study from Wendy Ron and Eric Oliver shows just that, which is to say people who like Donald Trump severely mistrust political elites, and they deeply mistrust people who are experts, who have any sort of expertise over an issue.
Right.
And so if those two groups criticize Trump, he can say, see, this is just part of that same system that's, you know, that's making your life harder and unfair. And the other thing that the group that likes Trump has in common, besides the mistrust of those two groups, is a strong national identity, which I think you see on his hat, right? Make America Great Again,
mm-hmm.
right into that message that can keep his discussion going in a direction that he would prefer. But I want to say that, you know, it may be the case that it's hard for journalists to press Trump, but it wouldn't be hard for them to say, I'm sorry, but if you're not going to answer my question, our interview is over. That would be dramatic television. That would get played over and over.
Right.
Click-worthy. It would be run ad nauseum. And it wouldn't be difficult in an interview to say, I'm sorry, if you can't tell me how you're going to pay for the wall, I guess we're done talking.
Oh, there's an interesting thought. Let's go to some phone calls. We have many of them. Joshua in southwestern Wisconsin. Hi, Joshua. Joshua, go ahead. All right, Joshua, you're going to have to, I don't know what, you're going to have to call again because we can't hear you. Zach in Appleton.
Hi, I just want to thank you so much for doing this show. I think it's really important. I think all of your guests are exactly right where the momentum's coming from. I'm a Democrat myself, and I'm considering a Trump vote just because of that. I hate politicians so much for what they're doing, for how corrupt they are, for the lack of actions connected to their substance. I know that you had mentioned that you're really frustrated with the lack of substance, but even for the politicians in the past that have had substance, if you look at what they've done, a lot of times they don't particularly do it. I don't think politicians are coming up with a lot of the ideas on their own anyway, so the fact that Trump doesn't have any is not all that surprising. And as terrible and awful as he is as far as the things he says, at least you know exactly what you're getting, which with any other politician, you never really know what kind of backdoor deal they have going on.
Yeah, and what do you think you're getting, Zach? What are you getting from him?
I think we're getting a political revolution, to be honest with you. It's totally different, and we've had enough. And I'm undecided. I'm undecided, but I think that's what Trump stands for. It's a political revolution.
Jay.
Well, when I listen to that, which I can definitely identify with, I keep thinking about all of the years of what I've called leave it there coverage, where a person on one side of our political divide says black and the other says white, and the discussion is just left there. And that, the he said, she said regime, the how long it took for fact-checking, which is actually a recent thing in the press, to come on board, the tolerance of just allowing discussion that never connected to go on, the endless recitation from the political class of polarized opposites, that kind of futility in our political dialogue, which went on for years and years and years, there's a price for that.
Let's go next to Joshua in southwestern Wisconsin. Hi, Joshua.
Hello, yes, I am calling to comment from a working class point of view. You know, I farm and I work full-time off the farm as well, and, you know, I think the rhetoric to Donald Trump is that the average person who works a lot is just tired of the way things are going. You know, it seems like more and more is taken from us, and I think that's why he's doing so popular. I do question whether he can really be trusted, but if, from a working man's point of view, if my vote has to go between Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, I will vote Donald Trump. You know, I don't think any of them can be trusted. So, and I don't see where any of them really are appealing to the hard working class. You know, and I would have to question some of Trump's motives and why he's even running for president when he's rich, which he's made that clear, that he's very rich and popular. So I don't know if he would do much for the working class anyways. So I'll take the comment off air.
Okay, thank you. Jay, what do you say?
Well, I think it's really important for people who think of themselves as professionals, whether they're professional journalists or professional politicians or political professionals who work as advisors and consultants, to realize that they can't do their job without trust. The whole premise of a professional is that the public trusts you to do the thing that you really know. And when that trust is eroded to a certain point, there is nothing you can do as a professional that will make any difference. And I think it's clear that the political system has reached that point.
And let's go to Daryl in Couderay. Hi, Daryl.
Hello, Kathleen. The first thing is you don't give Trump airtime. And the second is you don't vote for him. But I think we watch it because it's entertainment. It's the entertainment of fear, and that's attractive and entertaining to people. It's our addiction. I call it the cowboy way, the American way. And it's simple to explain. Cowboy has two things, attitude and guns, or in Trump's case, money. And they always use both.
Professor Rosen.
There was an extraordinary article in the Washington Post today about Trump suing a journalist who had written about his wealth. And he admits in an interview that he did with the Post reporter that he knew he didn't have any chance of winning. He just wanted to make the guy's life difficult and cost him a lot of money.
Oh, my.
And he could, so he did.
So he did.
Yeah, which is sort of just confessing, I'm a bully.
Yeah, exactly, which is so easy to see. Thank you so much, Jay Rosen, for being with us. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Yeah, our connection. Michael, I thank you. I hope you can hear me. Our connection failed with you. I'm sorry, but thank you, and we'll have you on again, please, for a much longer period of time. Michael Wagner. Jay is a journalism professor at NYU and Michael at UW-Madison. We also thank Brooke Gladstone, and thanks for all of your calls. If you didn't get on the air, you know, I'm trying to figure this out, too, so go to our Facebook page. We'd love to read comments from you. That is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the hour, and to Scotty as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We're with you again tomorrow with some interesting conversations, so stay with us.